Good morning, everybody. This thing is really close to me because I don't have a button thing going on, so you can turn it down a little. Welcome, everybody. We are here this morning to study in the book of Revelation, specifically Revelation chapter 14. Eric's not here. Where is Eric, anyway? Indio, that's right. That's right. Well, probably not a bad day for Indio today. Let's just get a little bit of preview or review of Revelation before we get into it too much. Eric's been doing a great job of keeping the scope of how we're looking at this very broad and very wide. It did have a very broad audience, so that makes a lot of sense. I tend to believe that regardless of who you are, when this was presented to you during that day, it should have brought some sort of meaning. We see a lot of Jewish terms in here, which makes a lot of sense. After all, the church is an offshoot of the Jewish nation. But as we know, this is not specifically to the Jews. It's to everybody. And so we have people during the day who were more than likely slaves, slave owners, people coming out of a very idolatrous relationship with their communities and with their governments and that sort of thing. All sorts of things getting ready to happen are already happening to a certain degree. The church is not that old. 30-something years old. That's not that old. So that's how we're looking at it. I think that's a good way to look at it. Just to go through this really quick, in the intro, we have, you know, who is it to? These seven churches in Asia. We have this throne scene in chapter 4, which kind of opens up. I mean, if it was a movie, it would have been just this fantastic thing to see. I'm sure it was for John when he saw it. We see this idea of these scrolls, and we're looking for somebody who is worthy to open the scrolls, which immediately tells us we're trying to establish some sort of authority. And this is really where God, I think, is trying to take this whole thing is we are under a lot of different authorities, but you need to look to Him as the ultimate authority. And we're not talking about our physical lives, because these folks are going to be required to die for their beliefs. There's this idea of the Christian being sealed. In other words, God knows who you are. Things are going to happen very quickly in these coming chapters. What I'm going to tell you, they're pretty awful things, but I know who you are and you belong to me, which is no small thing. When God says anything, it's not, He doesn't have to promise, but we see things as promises just because of what He says. And, I mean, He spoke everything into existence. So when God says, I know who you are, it brings that weight to that statement. We see these partial judgments, 8 through 10. Then we see the specific reference to the temple, which I thought brings with it a lot of Jewish issues and people, not issues, but people with Jewish backgrounds would be able to get something from that. Whether it's the actual destruction of the temple or not, I don't know. 12 through 13, we see the war on saints happening. And this is where we're going to find the contrasts. And this is, you know, I put my own little title up there. You know, where is your allegiance? Because really, I think this is what John is trying to evoke, is we need to have an allegiance here. And it's the same allegiance that God has always required. It is either to Him or it's to something else. If it's not to God, then it's against God. And that is what he's trying to bring forward. We see that happening here with the war on the saints, people being deceived, believing that they can worship this beast, whatever he is. And you know, I think the interpretation in there is, you know, obviously the things that they were doing during the day, there was emperor worship, there was all sorts of idolatry through the land, weird pagan rites and sort of things that happened throughout the land. So before we begin, let's have a word of prayer. Holy Father, thank you, Lord, for giving us this beautiful day. We thank you that we can be together and that we can hold your word in our hands and read from it. And we pray that you would be with us during this hour, in Christ's name. Amen. Okay. It was very beautiful this morning, actually, wasn't it? Still kind of raining a little bit. The sun was out and birds were singing. It was really nice. Okay, so I didn't want to pigeonhole this whole chapter, but I kind of see it. The more I read it, the more I see that in this part of the book, there is this idea of who are you going to be? Are you going to be one of the sealed, or are you going to be these other people who are marked? And we saw that contrast last week in chapter 13, where if you are among those that are worshiping, I'm assuming the emperor, or if you're just a part of that, emperor worship, idolatry, whatever it may be, you're just on the other side. And God has a way, and people don't like this, God has a way of making and when he makes a line in the sand, it's there, and it's there. You're either on one side or the other. And this is obviously goes against what we are taught today, I think. So, okay. Verses 1 through 6 of Revelation. The questions we want to answer are, what is the main idea of the text? What are the messages of the three angels, which I think come after this? And what is the call of the Christian, and why is it needed? And what does the imagery of the sickle mean? And we're going to see these harvest happening. And I have a question about later, a question about the cup of God's wrath, and what does that mean? And I'm still not sure I know. Okay, verse 1. Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the roar of many waters, and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they were singing a new song before the throne, and before the four living creatures, and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. And it is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouth was no lie, for they are blameless. So, what's the main idea of that text? Anybody?
First of all, there's a contrast between 13 and 14. One is the fact that the one out of the sea versus the one on the side.
Okay.
Things are on one side, and then the allies who destroy the dragon and the false prophets are on the other.
Okay, good. Yeah, we see these contrasts right away. We just read about what was happening with this beast and the deceiving. Now all of a sudden we see this emerging of Christ coming. Anything else? I believe it's Christ. I mean, whenever I see the Lamb, I have to think that. Any ideas on this new song, and what's this new song? And these people, only certain people could sing it. Yes.
Okay.
And again, I agree with that. Anybody else on that? Anybody not agree with that? It's okay. I agree with that. I mean, again, we have these contrasts, constantly these contrasts with the old and the new, and what's right, what's wrong, where do you want to be, which side are you going to be on? Yes, Virginia. Right. When we think of the song that they sang after they crossed the Red Sea, or it is usually after victory. And I agree. Exactly. And this is what the people hearing it want to hear. They want to hear that there's going to be some way for them to overcome what's happening. Yeah, we have this new song, and I think, again, for the Jew, they would understand this, that this is not only for me, when I read it, this is the end of the Bible, and I say that every time I get up here. But for the Jew, they may be thinking, oh, this is different. I mean, Jesus is here now, and what does that mean for our old, for the old era? Yes, Kathy.
I like what Virginia said about the contrasting, and also to go along with that, that in verse 2, I believe it is, that the faithful, or the 144,000 of the saints, have a mark on them, is written on the forehead.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, they have their mark too, the ones that follow Satan.
Yes, and we're going to read, we just read about who those were, didn't we? We're going to read about that again in here. We read about the sealing in chapter 7, that's the mark, and then in chapter 13, the mark of the beast is on people who follow him. And today we're going to read about both. And that's why I came up with that title. It's like, well, you need to kind of pick a side here. And that is the simple message to anybody who's going to read this. Now, what about this 144,000? Is that a literal condition that these people had to be? They had to be virgins? Or is that just a... Yes? Jim? It's interesting. Anybody else?
Are you trying to say that 144 is literal?
No, it's not 144 literal. It's 144 just represents all the Old Testament saints, because no more Old Testament saints can be added.
Well, I'm not sure we're not taking that one literal.
No. Yeah.
There would be a group for some of my quote.
Yeah, that's a very small number when you think about the billions of people and souls. Yeah, That's an interesting point. I just kind of looked at it like, whenever I see the number 12, I tend to see things as a governmental, you know, like the 12 sons and the 12 tribes and how things are divided up. And in a similar sense, these are the first fruits, so that point would carry pretty well. As well, though, and for me, when I looked at it, it was just a symbol, a symbolic number of anybody who was not performing idolatry. Because we know that idolatry was rampant during the day and included all of this sexual immorality. That was part of it. But when idolatry is practiced, God takes it personally. Like, you know, you belong to me, but now you're going off with somebody else. And I sort of saw it that way as well. I think that's a good point. I think it could, you know, again, for whoever was reading this, it had to carry some meaning. Again, I have to wonder how this letter was dispensed. It had to be, in my opinion, it had to be regulated tightly by John. I would only imagine that John himself did it, and if somebody had the spirit in them to be able to interpret it, they were able to go off and teach it as well. So whatever these are, I would imagine that it was a very tightly regulated way of dispensing it. Kay and then Kathy. I don't know. They maybe so. I don't know. I don't know where that came from. Kathy?
Well, in verse 4 and following, it talks about how good these people are.
Mm-hmm.
The very good people.
They're blameless, yes.
Yeah. They weren't defiled. They were fully loyal. They were bought and purchased by God. They were not false teachers, which in chapter 13, you know, we have those false teachers. So, again, with that contrast, it's just really interesting. And it wasn't like Israel had the false teachers. And they were the ones that were having the other nation become defiled.
Yeah, I would agree that, especially during this day, that they had kind of lost sight of what God really wanted, and previous to that as well. But they were the nation that that brought Jesus as well. So, you know, that's why God was dealing with them, because this is where His Son was going to come from. Anybody else? Virginia. Well, were they blameless? Truly, are any humans blameless? No. Yeah, we're all part of that. So that's what kind of pushes me to, and I think most everybody, to the interpretation that this is really just a symbol of what God's going to do for us. He's already talked about how that's going to happen, and. For some reason, some people interpret this to say, oh, you know, there's only going to be 144,000. You know, I was up, one of the other times I was up here teaching this class, I had this 144,000 come up thing. I don't know what it is. And there's only one way to do that. And that goes all the way back to the chapter of the one that's worthy, and that's through Jesus. Okay, any questions? Okay.
Something I read says that being defiled by women was where they had their temples, you know, and their temple
prostitutes. I don't know if I'm following you on that. As far as...
Defiled by women.
Mm-hmm.
Women were made for
right.
men.
Right.
So if they were made for men, they were not made to defile them.
No, you're right. But there is a relationship that a man can have, a sexual relationship a man can have with a woman, and it would be a defilement. Yes. And that's like temple prostitutes under the fornication idea. Or if you're married, as is the case that Hosea depicted, you know, we belong to God, and God says, here's how I feel about all this. Go marry a prostitute and then see how it feels. Kathy.
One more thing to say. You were talking about the 144,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they were numbered from the 12 tribes in chapter 7.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Standing before the throne and before the Lamb. So we know it is figurative, and there's many more people. So I agree with what Jim says, that, I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah. For me, when I see that word first fruits, I can't help but think about what Paul taught about the Jews being the first fruits of God. And that just makes sense. Yes. Just move on in a minute.
There's a lot of background.
Yeah.
I need to get to where I am at. But the 144,000 being the Old Testament saints, then it stops at Christ, and we are part of the multitude.
Yeah.
Because we're still being added. That's why there's no number. We're still baptizing people, and that's why it's called a great multitude, because the number is not fixed.
Yeah, we see that in the next section. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, let's read that. 6 to 13. And here's where the question comes up. What are the message? What are the messages of the three angels? There's actually six angels in this chapter, but these three angels, I think, is what he's trying to get to. Then I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. And he said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea, and the springs of water." Another angel, a second, followed, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality." And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or his hand, he will also drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night. These worshipers of the beast and its image, and whoever receive the mark of its name." Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. "And I heard a voice from heaven saying, 'Write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, and they may, that they may rest from their labors and for their deeds follow them.'" Okay, there, to me, reading that, I found the key verses were in verse 7, 12, and 13, where fear God, and there's this call for endurance, and then blessed are those that die in God, which that just seems like the message for those who are about to endure all those things. So that was my take on it. What is the text saying here? What is the main idea behind this text? What is it trying to do for us? Anybody? Kathy?
Well, I'm just going to comment on verse 6.
Okay. Okay, what very important part is in verse 6, to me anyway? You have an eternal gospel. And again, God's petitioning to these people's souls. He's petitioning for them to think in a spiritual way. Yes, all these awful things are going to be happening all around you, but here's a gospel that's eternal. Oh, okay, well, that's a lot longer than the 70 years I expected to live, or 50 years or whatever it might be. So there's this idea of thinking beyond the physical, thinking beyond the here and now. Virginia.
See, but the way I looked at it, about
because especially with the planet, with some respects, because I guess because ordinarily, I guess they would be drunk all day and all night.
Right. So they mix it with water, yeah.
Yeah,
somebody explain that to me, this whole idea of the cup of wrath. And I mean, we read, you know, even Christ is, you know, when Jesus is praying, he talks about, you know, let this cup pass from me. What does that all mean? What does it mean? I mean, I read a few things about it. I think when you get to the end, you see what's happening, how the wine is actually made. But I don't know that that's really what it means here. Yes, Randy. Okay.
Not here, this cup of wrath.
Okay.
It means totally understand that cup of blessing means cup of wrath. This draws a clear line between rest
and no rest. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
That's what I'm thinking is I think it's a picture of hell.
Okay. So if we're going to answer the question about what are these three angels saying, the message, the first message is this eternal gospel. That's how I saw it. Fear God, give him glory. Which, I mean Solomon said, right? I mean, wisdom starts with fearing God first, you know, to paraphrase. It just seems like he's reiterating something that people within the Jewish community should have known all the time. Anything else for this first angel on what he's trying to say? Because the hour of his judgment, yes. Yeah. And we're going to see here that we've kind of seen that these guys, people have been sealed. We see what's going, and then this idea of presenting what the government is doing, what different religions are doing, and how they, you know, they're kind of intermingled, and how these people will suffer because of their faith. But regardless of that, irregardless of that, God is in ultimate authority here. And we see that throughout the entire book. God keeps saying, yes, this is happening in your life, but I have the final authority. Yes, your life will not be so good. Your life will be horrible. People will knock on your door and drag you out. But be ready to give your life. That's a big thing to ask, and he knows that. But I think he understands that this is what needs to happen for the church to stay established. Yes. Alan?
In the same vein, where it tells us that we want to give our lives up for our wives, I think that's the easy way out, because it's over.
That's right.
It's a whole other deal.
Yeah, take out the trash and do the dishes several times a week. Yeah. Take the hard way. Am I doing the dishes again? Is that tonight? I don't know. Yeah. We practice love. This second angel, what is his message? Or Babylon is fallen. And I know for me, and I'll just say this right out, and you can tell me what you think. Right out, when I read that, I think Rome. Rome has fallen. Of course, we're not going to say Rome, because if you're carrying this letter and you say Rome has fallen, you're going to be arrested. And if you're lucky, you'll get your head cut off. More than likely not. Anybody else? Yes.
Okay. There are 14 verses in Revelation that identify Rome, oh, Babylon. And one in I just got a list. I haven't got a specific list right now, but it says that it should be utterly destroyed. Rome was never utterly destroyed. Mm-hmm. If you Google Rome, you'll find Eternal City, because it was never destroyed.
Right. And?
And it's Jerusalem.
Okay. The only I think probably the only argument I would have with that is that Jerusalem fell, but it didn't affect anybody's life in the seven cities that this was written to. They could have, you know, half of the people in the church probably lamented over the fact that the nation that brought Christ was destroyed, but ultimately it didn't affect them. Perry.
What we're talking about is the Roman Empire, not the city of Rome itself.
Right.
So we're talking about
the influence.
The influence.
Right.
Particularly with the term, with this idea of idolatry and Babylon and those kinds of things, the influence that they had over the religious lives of the inhabitants. Correct. Christianity was tearing that apart left and right.
Yeah.
And it just crumbled under its own weight eventually.
Right.
And
I know Jim has something to say, and I agree with that. That again, this is a very abstract idea that's being put out, especially for people who are being asked to die, and they're looking at it, going, "Well, Rome's they're still very powerful. What's going on here?" But again, God is talking about authority. He's saying, I know what you think is what it looks like. I have authority. What they're doing, they're gone. And God does that at some point where he says, you're my child, but I have to let you go. I have to give you over. So I know you had something else you wanted to add.
Yeah, you were saying that it didn't affect other cities.
It didn't affect those people is what I'm saying. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I agree. It affected the Jews. But if I wasn't a Jew, if I was a Greek, or if I was a Roman citizen, born a Roman citizen, and had no ties to the Jews other than being a Christian, the fact that it fell would not affect me like it would somebody who was a Jew. That's all I'm saying. Kathy? Those are all valid arguments, and I remember reading them and looking at those like that as I've studied this book. But it seems like the more I study it, the more I try to just make it more applicable to whoever was reading it. If a Jew was reading it, it needed to apply to them. If it was a Roman citizen who had Greek heritage or Asian heritage or whatever, it had to apply to them as well. Yes. Thank you. Yes, I agree with that. I agree with that. We're not even going to get close. One of the things that I find compelling is that what's happening there, to a very, very severe degree, is do these things happen in our country today when it comes to religion and who can you believe and what can you believe in? Religions, and are there religions today that depict some of this where we live? Yeah, absolutely. There are certain religions that say, well, it doesn't, you know, in the very nation we live in, you're free to worship however you wish, as long as you're not hurting anybody, and teach any god that you want. And God tells us, you have to be on one side or the other. There's no, we don't get a choice when you're believing in the Yahweh God. Okay, real quick, this third angel teaching and saying, if anyone worships the beast, what's going to happen to them? You're going to be judged. You're going to be judged along with them. In other words, okay, remember when in chapter 13 you were getting this mark? If you have that mark, that's where you're going to be end up with everybody else. So in this last section, we'll go ahead and read that. This is essentially what's going to happen. And we kind of see these, I don't want to say there were two harvests, but we certainly see a specific harvest of people who are going to receive judgment. Verse 14. Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the white cloud, one like a son of man, with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, that's important, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe. So he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, which is important. The angel who has authority over fire, and he called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle. Put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, for its grapes are ripe. So the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the grape harvest of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and the people flowed, and the blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia. Does anybody know how far 1,600 stadia is? I'll have to look that up. That's a lot of blood. In other words, 184 miles, and I don't know if it's the bottom of the bridle or if it's in the bit or part, but that doesn't matter, does it? It's just a lot. It's a big mess, is what it's trying to say. A lot of people are going to be under God's judgment, I think, is all this is saying. Right? So, I thought it was important that we see these commands coming from the temple and from the altar. It brings with it that idea of authority again. This is coming from God. This is from his realm. And he's bringing these judgments down. Does anybody have any thoughts on this section at all? What does the imagery of the sickle mean? What does this mean? Mm-hmm. What is the idea of this sickle? Why do we see this? What is this harvest of? Harvest of?
Okay.
Well, I'm thinking God's collecting souls. Yeah, no? Or not collecting souls? And we see these, there's two of them. There's one. What happens to the first batch of people? Souls. Anybody? Do we know? What does it say? So he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. So it appears to be this. There appears to be this reaping, and no specific outcome of that reaping. And then there's another reaping that happens, and it is of grapes. And what happens with the grapes? They put in the wine press. You know, the first time I read that, I thought of a real press where you kind of screw down the thing. But this is actually like a trough that you would put the grapes in, and then you'd step on it. So we see, again, there's this contrast. Again, there's this reaping of the earth. You don't see any judgments against these people necessarily. They're just taken. And then we see the second reaping, a specific fruit. That's the grapes. Are the grapes good or not good by our estimation? Evil? Okay. Yeah, certainly wrath was impugned on these. So we have to assume that these are the enemies of God, because God is exacting judgment on them. It's full strength. Full strength. Yeah. What is that whole idea of the God's cup of wrath and all of that? You have about 30 seconds, I think. Anybody? Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.